Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. I'm Sarah LaDuc in for Joe Donahue this morning for the music that was, you are likely to have recognized, Melissa Etheridge performing Come to My Window, but it's from a new album, I'm Not Broken, live from Topeka Correctional Facility, a relatively new live album that is the soundtrack in like partnership with a film coming out about Melissa Etheridge and the individuals incarcerated at the Topeka Correctional Facility. Melissa Etheridge is on tour with the Indigo Girls, and they're playing Bethel Woods next Wednesday. That is the 21st of August. So Melissa Etheridge and the Indigo Girls will be at Bethel Woods next Wednesday. The music this morning from Melissa Etheridge's album, I'm Not Broken, live from Topeka Correctional Facility. The playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. It is time now to discuss current events with some fantastic panelists. Joining me this morning, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, doing double duty again this week. Hello, Teresa.
Hi, delighted to be here.
I know, you're so excited to talk about the news every day. It's really inspiring how jazzed you are all the time about this.
Weirdly, I am. I know it's weird, but okay. And next week for me is like the Super Bowl for other people, sure, at the convention. So I know I'm odd, but I just, you know.
Great.
Any day that you'll have me, I'll talk about it from now until election day.
Okay, Doug. Good to know. Thanks for being here today. Also in studio, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Doing well.
Great.
Not quite as closely following this stuff as Teresa, but definitely get it excited.
But I have questions for you, though. So.
Yes. Her energy can buoy us all. Also in studio, senior fellow at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff. Hi, Fred. How are you?
Hi, Sarah. Delighted to be here. Good to see you.
Good to see you. How was your week?
The week's been terrific so far. Lots of pool time.
Oh, good. Good, good. Oh, that's what you want in August,
like
if you can manage
pool
it.
Swimming pool or like...
Yeah, no. Pool. Swimming pool.
Oh.
Betting on things. All right. Let us go to Europe in our minds. You know what I mean. This updates on the Russian and Ukraine conflict. Russian troops are closing in on the strategic city in Ukraine, an eastern Ukrainian town of Pokrovsk, according to open-source battlefield maps, casting doubts on Ukraine's hopes that its new offensive into western Russia will prompt Moscow to scale back its attacks elsewhere on the battlefield. Russian forces are about 8 miles from the city, one of Ukraine's main defensive strongholds in the Donetsk region, according to the maps, which are based on combat footage and satellite images. This coming a day after we heard that Ukrainian troops took full control of the Russian town of Sudzha. President Volodymyr Zelensky said yesterday that would be Ukraine's first capture of a Russian urban center since its troops launched a surprise attack into the country 10 days ago. Sudzha is a small town about 6 miles from the border. It quickly fell into the path of Ukrainian troops sweeping into Russian territory over the past week, and military experts have said in recent days that Ukrainian forces had seized most, if not all, of the town. The capture of Sudzha could further lift the spirits of Ukrainian civilians and soldiers who have already been buoyed by Kyiv's daring and so far relatively successful incursion after months of losing ground at home. So that was the news yesterday, and then the news this morning or overnight that Russia is taking towns that they maybe hadn't before. How does this all look right now? We'll start with you, Fred.
Yeah, I think notwithstanding the Ukrainian success in this incursion, which is indeed very heartening, the salient fact is still in eastern Ukraine, where Russian forces are pressing against Ukrainian defenders. The Russians have a manpower advantage of about 5-1. All right, it would seem that the Ukrainian incursion into Russia is aimed at trying to force the Russians to divert forces from their positions in eastern Ukraine. It's a little bit early to assess whether or not that's going to be successful. I suspect, even though this has been extraordinarily embarrassing for Russian President Vladimir Putin, I suspect his best course of action is to contain this incursion as best he can without diverting a lot of forces and continue to press in eastern Ukraine. The Russians still enjoy a significant artillery advantage, something that, you know, ultimately will be evened out a bit. The United States and other Western countries are providing additional resources, but it takes time for these things to get into the country. And the best estimates I've seen suggest that that the Ukrainians will have something approaching sufficient artillery shells sometime in the fall or winter. So good operation, surprise operation. American and Western weaponry has come in very handy in this thing, but whether it's going to alter the basic demographic facts on the ground, probably too early to tell.
Yeah, I would say that you know, there have been two things that haven't yet been verified completely, but that are interesting. One is that apparently what Russia has done is they're sending, you know, their third string team in. So the group that's going to fight the current Ukrainian thing are essentially almost untrained Russian soldiers who are being rushed into the battle. So in a sense, Russia can do what it can to keep that down while still keeping its main forces where they are. So I agree with you on that. The other thing that was mentioned was that Ukraine has now made some drone strikes very deep into Russia. And I think, you know, that's being downplayed a lot because, again, the Putin response. But it's sort of saying, you know, if you're going to bomb Kyiv, we can hit Moscow. We haven't done it yet, but, you know, we have that capability. So I think there's a lot going on here, which often happens in these kind of things, where strategic things are being done that have more to do with looking for an end game, looking for a way out, looking for something. But this one, you know, I just don't... The only potential easy end game I see is a Republican takeover in the U.S. that basically just shuts Ukraine out of our funding, and then, you know, becomes Western Europe's best chance, and that's hard. That's going to be hard without us. Pulling out of NATO would be the most insane thing we could possibly do, and we have a presidential candidate who's been wanting us to do that for a long time.
Which one? So. Just kidding.
I know on the radio we can't endorse anyone, but I do know that we could criticize, and I'm very happy to criticize. But it's not just the Trump campaign. It's the strong Republican support that he's able to get. So, you know, if the Republicans take the House or the Senate, then the problem becomes even with a Democratic president, you can veto things, but it's very hard to push things through. Teresa, you probably know way more about that than I do.
Yeah, well, actually, in preparing for this, I figured that on the ground it would be Fred talking about this, but I wanted to really understand what the bigger picture of where we're going, because we're so close to the election. And I found what I thought was a fascinating story by Michael Hirsch in Politico. It was written July 2nd, 2024, and I highly recommend it. Trump's plan for NATO is emerging. And it was a deep dive into the people who had been his national security advisors in the last administration, those he continues to surround himself with, and where they are on these issues, and so where they think Trump is going to be. And they call for a quote-unquote radical reorientation in which Washington takes the backseat to Europe and cuts a deal with Putin over Ukraine. And this is, you know, Trump's been signaling this for a while, and J.D. Vance is signaling this. And interestingly, J.D. Vance has been talking about how, you know, young people, he hasn't said, seem to be gravitating toward Harris, but he says, you know, the young people, they should be concerned about do you want to go to war or not, because we're not going to send you to war to fight other people's wars, which is, I think, you know, sort of all things. But it really talks about how he will talk about getting out of NATO, but he won't completely get out of NATO because he can't. But he will push for what they call a two-tiered system. So if you paid your full 2%, you get more coverage than you don't. which would end with Article 5, which basically says any NATO members will come and support you, right? And so that would obliterate the Article 5. And it talks about how it really will shift all of the, you know, on-the-ground support away from the U.S. and with the expectation that European countries handle that, which they don't have the capacity to do, and that the U.S. would really just focus on more cybersecurity and intelligence and those kinds of things. But they are calling for a complete reorientation. So that's one of the things I was curious and concerned about, because it would certainly, and they say it's for the purpose of strengthening our focus on China, but it seems to me that there's so much interconnectedness now that it would only the unintended consequences would be to weaken our position against China, because it's better to come in as a, you know, alliance than it is alone. But you're the...
Yeah, no, look, if the United States is seen by Beijing as basically folding up on Ukraine, inevitably the Chinese will draw conclusions about the willingness of the United States to defend Taiwan, okay, and you know, in that kind of a situation, it's very, very dangerous. One of the things that I find encouraging about recent policy shifts in the current administration, and Jim alluded to this, is the willingness of the United States to see the Ukrainians using our weapons to strike targets in Russia. In my personal view, and I suspect this is the case in terms of policy, I think the main thing we're telling the Ukrainians now is, under no circumstances should you imitate Putin by targeting civilian populations.
Yeah.
You know, you want to smack a Russian airbase? Go for it.
And that's what they're doing.
Go
here,
for
right?
it.
And
before
that's
drone
what they're doing
strikes
now.
Or all Air Force
now
bases,
they're
yeah.
using they're using right. drones quite effectively.
And they created a humanitarian corridor right away, yep. right? In this incursion yep. into the community, yep. the towns they created. I guess what did they? Yeah. They yep. several towns, but they created immediately humanitarian yep. corridors and in returning the Russian soldiers yeah. who were killed back to Russia.
But
which
this policy shift on our part has been a long time coming. And in my opinion, it's welcome. It gives the Ukrainians a chance to defend their own civilians from from Russian terror attacks.
Can I say one other thing on this political article, if it's all to be believed? It seemed pretty well researched. But the other thing is that many of the people that they interviewed for this, who have been surrounding him and who were with him before, are the architects of the foreign policy portions of Project 2025. So can I say another, the Jim Hendler question?
Go, do your thing, Teresa.
Because I've been wondering, when they were talking about Ukraine, right, this offensive that they just had, they talked about how they were able to, what would be, to pierce their air coverage. So with satellite, you know, because they had satellite information, is that still, are they still using Starlink? Is that still Elon Musk, or do you know?
I don't know, but I don't think so. I mean, I think Elon, so Starlink was providing primarily the equivalent of internet broadband type coverage, right? And the military had been using it. I think when Musk shut that off, they moved to a multiple communication thing. I think what that really impacted, and again, this is mostly inference from things we've read, is to understand that a lot of what we have always seen as Russian cyber attacks and Russian cyber criminals, ransomware, et cetera, were actually Russian-funded groups who lived in Ukraine or who worked from Ukraine. It was easier to work for Ukraine for various reasons, having to do with the politics, et cetera, how the internet connectivities work, how you can trace things. So shutting down Starlink did make a big impact on so when the war started, all those Ukrainians who had been attacking us went back to attacking Russia. So Russia actually built their own enemy force, strangely enough. When Starlink was shut down, that did seriously impact the cyber attacks on Russia. And I don't know if that's been restored. I don't know what's going on because, you know, it's really hard to get any information on what's underneath this. But for example, when you get a drone to an Air Force base well inside a country, that means you have somehow bypassed some of the intelligence. How that happens, well, first of all, it's classified even if you were allowed to know. But in fact, a lot of that discussion happens within each of the countries. So, you know, I don't know that the U.S. would even know exactly how Ukraine is doing that.
It seemed that this incursion really exposed a weakness on the part of the Russians, right? I mean, they're not taking a big part of a land, but the fact that they were able to get in, isn't that, Fred? I mean...
Yeah, clearly Russian defenses were weak, but this is a real roll of the dice.
Yeah.
Because, again, the key fact is 5-1 personnel disadvantage on the part of Ukraine. I don't know exactly how many troops are involved in this incursion, but they are coming, you know, right out of the Ukraine's defensive posture. So this is this is not without risk.
But does
panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. We will come back and talk more about this topic after news from the BBC. The panel this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hedler, and Fred Hoff. Once again, the email address is panel at WAMC.org, and we will return momentarily. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc, in for Joe Donahue, in studio with Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Fred Hoff. Melissa Etheridge providing the music this morning from the album I'm Not Broken, live from Topeka Correctional Facility. Melissa Etheridge is on tour with the Indigo Girls this summer, and they're playing Bethel Woods next Wednesday. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and... we were talking about Starlink and learned some stuff about that during the break. Jim, can you update us?
Yeah. So one of the things that I must admit I wasn't aware of until I started looking carefully to answer Teresa's question is actually the Pentagon apparently has been funding Musk to provide Starlink.
So for people who don't know Starlink, why don't you explain
what
Starlink
is? So Starlink is a satellite-based internet system. So here in the U.S., most of our broadband goes through wires, cables, optical cables, et cetera. And so when we talk about extending broadband coverage to rural communities, we're really talking about a physical creation. Now, in a lot of the... countries that didn't put that investment in, they've moved instead to what's called a mobile internet. In some cases, a lot of Africa, a lot of South America, you know, essentially think of it as your cell phone becomes your primary internet connection. And they're using not exactly the same cell phone technology, but similar cell phone technology to us. Starlink is the next step up. You have a set of satellites going around, which basically, when I send a message on my thing, the internet takes it up to a satellite and back down again, and these satellites can communicate with each other. And then, you know, again, I'm not going to get into a two-hour lecture on networking, but the key thing is that Musk runs the company Starlink that put these up and is providing coverage to a number of countries, including Ukraine. So much of the Ukrainian internet capabilities come through Starlink. Now, at one point, I believe it was back in March of this year, the Ukrainians were starting to do some drone attacks, and Starlink got shut down, and there's a lot of debate over exactly how and why. But interestingly, some of the articles I was just looking at say that was Musk's way of forcing the Pentagon to give him more money. So,
and what troubles me is that because clearly we know Elon Musk has certain policy positions and people he favors, and $43 million to the Trump campaign. And so to have that kind of power in one person's hands, the ability to turn on, turn off, and the two of you could speak better than me about what that means in a time of war and incursion and what, but I just from reading, clearly it was important to have that satellite capability in this incursion, and through drone strikes and stuff, it's essential, right, Fred?
Yeah, my understanding, which is very limited, but it is that this is an important capability. As long as Mr. Musk is delivering on the terms of his contract with the Department of Defense, that's fine. It's a little bit off topic, but I suspect, and this is probably quite obvious, that the bromance between Musk and former President Trump is driven primarily by the fact that Elon Musk understands that if Vice President Harris becomes president, administration support for electric vehicles will continue. He doesn't have the same assurance with Donald Trump. And I think he's trying to create support by Trump and, and Trump's team for administration support for electric vehicles, Republicans succeed,
play both sides of the street.
Sure,
yeah, but
sure.
Isn't it also AI that the rules in the next the rules for AI will be written in the next administration, and he wanted to have some control over that? That's a statement.
Yeah. So Musk has his fingers in a lot of pies. Okay. So. Just as an example, NASA decided to try to get to not have to use SpaceX, one of Musk's companies, by contracting with Boeing to bring some people up to the space station, and they've been marooned there for 6 months. And now, who are they going to try to get them home?
SpaceX.
So
because the U.S. doesn't have its own transportation system anymore.
Well, because we essentially have outsourced a lot of our stuff, and it turns out many of these things have gone to companies that were traditional defense contractors and things like that. But the non-defense spaces, NASA, some parts of the DOE, a lot of the other agencies, OSHA, weather, et cetera, don't go through the DOD contractors. They go through external contracting, and now Musk has four or five companies that control a very large portion of that.
Thank you, George Bush, I think. We don't have our own public transportation system. We have to rely on a private transportation system to get our astronauts back from
I'm not sure I call it public. I'm just saying public transportation. We're not talking about buses here.
I'm sorry, I veered off of Ukraine.
That's okay. Panel at WAMC.
However, NASA is trying to take this back, by the way. The new moon mission, et cetera, is staying very closely under...
Led by RPI grads.
One of our RPI grads is one of the astronauts.
He's the commander.
He's the commander of the first flight, but that's different than...
I'm just trying
building.
To give you a little plug there, Jim.
Yeah, thank you. I was being... I'm sure if any of the RPI PR people are listening, they're getting mad at me.
But
the point I want to make is that NASA did pull back from outsourcing a lot of that mission, as I understand it. They're trying to really rebuild some of our own capabilities so as not to be dependent on both foreign players and on... So you still need a lot of companies to build the rockets and to... do all the other pieces and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think NASA is trying to take more of that control back. The space station is an international project, so
the
U.S. had less control. But we provide
the rides
back and forth for our astronauts.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel.
Not that we'd ever go up on a tangent.
I feel like this is like a Trump press conference, no, like totally off point, but it's interesting.
This is the show. It's always like this. You know that. You're here in the room more than I am.
I know.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation, be it the main thread or a tangent. We hope to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org. Let us add another item of news regarding Russia. This coverage from the BBC and New York Times. Yesterday, a court in Russia sentenced a dual citizen of Russia and the United States to 12 years in prison on accusations that she committed treason by donating money, about $50 American, to Ukraine's armed forces. So it's $50 could get you 12 years in prison. The court claimed to have found that the funds donated by the woman, Ksenia Karolina, were subsequently used to purchase tactical medicine equipment, weapons and ammunition for Ukraine. The prosecution nearly always gets its way in treason cases in Russia. Russia's state-managed and stage-managed judicial system. But her lawyer said he would still appear to try to get her sentence reduced. The attorney also said that she did plead guilty, but she admitted to transferring the money and believed that the funds would help victims on both sides. Fred.
Yeah, the Russian official case against this unfortunate person is amazing. This $51 contribution to a New York-based NGO focusing on humanitarian aid to Ukraine. This $51 was instrumental in arming the Ukrainian armed forces and facilitating Ukrainian operations against the Russian Federation. There's a lack of shame here that was obvious going into this. I mean, Vladimir Putin is in the business of taking hostages for trading purposes, and it's no more complicated than that. If you're an American citizen thinking about visiting Russia as a tourist or to visit family or whatever, please think again.
Yeah, the State Department is pleading with people, do not go to Russia.
Yeah.
Do not. But I, ever the optimist, am hoping that this is a positive sign, because as it was with Gerskovich with Wall Street Journal, because he, remember, there was a rushed trial and a long sentence. And when that happened, I said, I hope that's positive news, because that's typically a step before they negotiate for the final release. And that's what happened with Gerskovich. So I don't know if that's what's happening in this case, but it was apparently a rushed trial.
In other words,
trial.
The conviction being a precursor, yeah.
A precursor to
some kind of a deal.
Right, yeah. Because as I've read, that there's a pattern of having the final, saying that, the adjudication.
They want rule of law to prevail.
Prevail, yeah. I hate to call it adjudication because it's such a sham. But in any case, there has been a pattern with some of the people who I call them hostages, detainees, whatever the right word is. And I don't know if that's the case here, but I'm hoping for her sake that that's the case here.
And that was what we saw in Brittany Griner also.
Exactly. Within a few weeks or maybe months or not a long time after.
Right. In other words, she had been held for a while, mm-hmm. a lot of news, a lot of coverage, let the publicity build, and then the sentencing. I think this one, again, it's harder to tell how much the U.S. would be willing to barter on this one. So, again, I think it'll be part of a larger pattern, but I think that's the scary part, and I think Fred nailed it, which is that, what a lot of people were afraid of was that the previous swap would encourage Putin to do more of it. On the other hand, there were people who were saying, some of the people he had to return were people he really wanted to keep. So, it plays both ways. And that's always the case with a hostage kind of situation. You're really in a tough situation.
It's an impossible situation. I mean, there's no doubt, objectively speaking, that when you do deals of this nature, it encourages the criminal party to continue. But really, what choice do we have?
Right.
I mean, the first objective of American foreign policy is the protection of American citizens overseas.
Yep.
And clearly, President Biden is deeply committed to that, as are the people in the State Department. I do think that there has, it appears based on what I've read, that Mark Vogel, who's the teacher who was teaching at the U.S. school there and who seems to be beloved by a lot of both the reporters who are in Russia and the other State Department folks, there seems to be a lot of push to get him out. And my guess is before the end of the Biden administration, they're really trying to get him out. So I'm wondering if this is part of a, it will be part of a, the next round of a deal.
Perhaps,
to that there'll be a couple of them that they get out in exchange for whatever. But and I, my sense is that there's a push to try to do that before the change in administration, particularly in case Trump wins.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. It is time for us to take a brief pause, and we will return momentarily. You are listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to The Roundtable panel. Music this morning from Melissa Etheridge's album, I'm Not Broken, live from Topeka Correctional Facility. Melissa Etheridge on tour with the Indigo Girls, playing Bethel Woods next Wednesday. The playlist posted online at WAMC.org. You can join the conversation by emailing us at panel@WAMC.org. And in studio with me this morning, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, and Senior Fellow at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff. We do have some email from listeners, so let us enter those in on for, to the record. first from Jeff, writes in and says, to your panel, Putin takes advantage of the situation where he can kidnap someone inside Russia in exchange for something someone of value later on, just like Trump took classified documents because he saw their value in a future exchange, most likely for cash. Once again, using the autocrat's playbook. Comments? None? That's okay to have none.
I guess there are allegations out there that the former president held on to the documents because he wanted to sell them for cash. I personally don't. I don't think that's the case. I think the retention of those documents had had a lot more to do with ego, with a sense of entitlement, rather than trying to turn them into some kind of rather than marketing them.
But it is a reminder about how a person who's running for president handled classified documents. And I just don't understand how Republican leaders, and I'll put those in quotes, like McConnell and others, can support a person for the presidency who treated classified information in the way that Donald Trump treats classified information. That has to be very unnerving for the Pentagon. It has to be very unnerving, and Fred, you could speak to this much, you know, personally, but for people at the State Department, for people in the NSA, for people who do this incredibly dangerous work, to know that their commander-in-chief does not respect the importance of classified information has to be deeply unsettling.
You know, I think there's probably no shortage of political people who have acted improperly with regard to retaining classified information after leaving office. I think there is no shortage. What makes this case different, at least as far as I can see, is the active attempt to conceal what had happened. I'm sure there are Republicans out there who will engage in whataboutism on this issue, pointing to President Biden's difficulties. But as far as I know, there were no attempts on the part of President Biden to conceal this stuff, to move it around, and to resist any attempt to investigate what had happened.
Well, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, people think documents are either classified or unclassified, right? There's an insanely complex system of labels and just what kind of classification and things like that. And which kind of documents were found, because by and large, within certain parts of the military, everything will be classified at a fairly low level, right? And those documents often end up somewhere simply because someone didn't realize they had them in the backpack or whatever. Even then, they get in trouble. But once it starts moving into those higher and higher levels where you have to get more and more clearances, then it becomes much more serious. And, you know, no one has said exactly what was found in Biden that I've seen, but the Trump things were what were called keyword classified, top secret documents. These are
clearly
these
labeled.
Are about as high as you can get, and very, you know, these are things that essentially went to, for things to get up to that level, they reveal where the information came from,
and
that means
sources.
That's what's dangerous, because again, if we have somebody who's providing information about what's happening in Russia or somewhere else, and Russia finds out, that person is at least going to jail, if not being poisoned by the KGB.
Once you get into sources and methods, you're in very, very, very extraordinarily dangerous territory.
And I think for the others, both Democrats and Republicans who were found with in possession of classified information, that was, for lack of a better description, essentially sloppiness in packing, right? That they,
in some cases,
that they, that stuff got packed in boxes when they started going through, they found them there. And then with Biden, the issue was, are your notes about classified information something you can or can't keep? And he believed you could, and he referenced those in writing his book, and there was a back and forth about that. But in general, both for Democrats and Republicans, the majority of the situation—I mean, there's some outlier individual cases, right? But anyway, too much on this. But
I will say one of my favorite conundrums of the potential November outcomes is— there are two hard and fast rules within the security community. One is the president always gets a clearance. Two is a convicted felon can never get a clearance.
Right.
I suspect the first will overrule the second if Trump gets in, but it'll be very interesting to see how that's treated by the intelligence community, who would not want somebody who'd been convicted to be holding this information.
And ironically, a person who reportedly rarely took advantage of the daily briefs of classified information is now upset because they won't give him a daily brief as a candidate. So anyway, we go astray.
We do.
On to healthcare.
No.
So where were you headed?
No, not
headed.
Yet.
No, we had a couple
more
letters.
We have letters. panel at WAMC.org is the email address. It's okay, Teresa. Steve wrote in and says, great discussion on Starlink today. Thank you. There is a great article from August of 2023 in The New Yorker by Ronan Farrow on how Musk and Starlink monopolize the global satellite system. Yeah. It's chilling. It's a must read. So that's a 2023 article in The New Yorker. Hmm. We heard from Gabor, who says—
And let me just throw in real quickly.
Sure.
You know, Meta actually made an attempt to do this. They were concentrating primarily on India. And India said, no, we do not want a foreign company to be dictating who can see what in our country. And many other countries just couldn't afford to make that decision.
Gabor wrote in and says, the fact that infrastructure for such a huge proportion of humanity's activities run through one man is one of the most astonishing flaws in national and global governance. Please talk about what needs to change to remove or at least minimize this concentration of power.
Everyone's pointing at me. Well, look, you know, I used to joke, oh God, it must have been 25 years ago, that, you know, the most dangerous man in America was Bill Gates. Not because I thought he was a bad guy. I actually liked him. But, you know, if Microsoft had turned off, you know, if they simply went to D.C. and said, unless you do what I say, we're just shutting down, you know, office, it would have paralyzed the country, right? Musk has built several different entities, most of which we're not dependent on in quite that same way. The government doesn't function on Musk's stuff. But Tesla, Starlink, SpaceX, I forget what, there's two or three others,
have very... Speak about X, because I think
Twitter,
X, of course.
Yeah,
controls information.
Right. Well, you know, again, I think it's very interesting seeing how that's played out. A lot of people have left. it's left behind a very different culture. But on the same time, a lot of news stations that are, you know, you can't give it up. When you have a million followers, you can't go somewhere else. There is nowhere else at the moment that has that capability. A lot of things have tried. And so, you know, it's a very tricky situation. And social media companies have a lot of control over what they will and won't allow. And that's going to be, you know, that's playing out on X. But I think that who gets their information from Twitter? This is what you were saying for Teresa in some of our conversations, is that, you know, some of the newer social media is growing. In, you know, it started with teens who are now, of course, in their 30s and 40s and playing with some of these new things. And so, you know, the power of X from a influencer point of view is not quite what it once was. Instagram has really taken over a lot of that space.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. The panel this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Fred Hoff. It is time now for regional news with Mr. Ray Graff. We'll be right back.
With a price on my head and a shadow of a black crow.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc. Music this morning from Melissa Etheridge's album I'm Not Broken, live from Topeka Correctional Facility. Melissa Etheridge is on tour with the Indigo Girls, and they're playing Bethel Woods next Wednesday. The playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc, filling in for Joe Donahue this morning, and I'm joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, and Senior Fellow at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff. How's everybody doing? Shall we move on to a new topic?
Sure.
We're good?
Sure.
All right. Let us discuss news this week about prescription costs and Medicare. Yesterday, the Biden administration unveiled the results of landmark drug price negotiations between Medicare and pharmaceutical companies. The negotiated prices, which will take effect in 2026, are expected to save billions of dollars for Medicare, which is funded by taxpayers. But they will lead to direct out-of-pocket savings for only a subset of the millions of older Americans who take the drugs subject to the negotiations. Other provisions of the law that created the drug negotiation program, such as capping patients' expenses for insulin and their yearly out-of-pocket drug costs, will do more to save older Americans money at the pharmacy counter than these price cuts on specific other meds. The 10 drugs subject to negotiations include widely used blood thinners and arthritis medications. Had the new prices been in effect last year, administration officials said Medicare would have saved $6 billion, which would have reduced its spending on those drugs by 22%. The negotiations, a longtime aspiration for Democrats, are the first that the federal government has directly conducted with drug makers on behalf of Medicare beneficiaries. The pharmaceutical industry, which has fiercely opposed the negotiation program, quickly criticized the new prices on Thursday, saying they would not help patients. Bristol-Myers Squibb, the maker of the blood thinner Eliquis, is one of the drugs subject to negotiations, said the drug's new price does not reflect the substantial clinical and economic value of this essential medicine. It's impossible to tell how much the new prices will save Medicare for each individual drug. The federal government does not disclose the net prices it pays for medications, which take into account the billions of dollars in discounts that reduce Medicare spending. But estimates from health economists who have analyzed Medicare's actual spending indicate that the new prices are lower than what the government had paid in recent years, with some drugs more discounted than others. Wall Street analysts, however, told investors that they thought the drug companies made out relatively unscathed, with discounts not much greater than what they already concede. A sigh of relief, analysts at the investment bank Leerink Partners wrote to investors, none of the big companies whose drugs were subject to negotiations had major swings in their stock prices on Thursday. As everything in the health system in America, a lot to discuss, a lot to wrap your mind around. Who would like to begin?
Well, let me just, you know, last week, Aaron Pacetti, the economist, was here. And one of the things he talked about was how many, what percentage of Americans actually owned stock, including in pension funds and things like that. It's a very small number. And the number that would actually be affected by the drug company thing, you know, the people they're reassuring are all all already have a whole lot of money, but this is, to me, a very important step. And, you know, it's only about 50 years late. Literally, the same exact drug that you can get in the U.S., made by the same exact drug maker, right, can cost you tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars per year, right, for some of the really serious ones. We're overseas. I mean, it's literally cheaper to become a citizen of an overseas country that has a healthcare system to get that drug. But, of course, that takes a year, and most people can't do it.
It's a complicated process.
Well, and not to mention that...
that also involves means and time.
Well, and when you're talking Medicare, Medicaid, you're talking people who are either elderly or poor, so you don't really have... and I'm one of them, so when I say elderly, it's scary. But the point being that this ability to negotiate based on your base, right, is just... how insurance works, how all sorts of things work. And the drug companies have always been given a pass because they claim that the cost of doing the research, the cost of developing the drugs has to be recuperated, whatever the word, that's not the word I'm looking for, but anyway, they got to get it back.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, during some of the testimony on this, a number of senators, including then-Senator Harris, right, in some of the early days of this, actually showed, you know, this is how much money you put into the research. This is how much money you're selling the drug for in the United States. This is how much you're selling the drug for overseas. And first of all, the pricing way exceeded their entire research budget, not just on that drug, but all the drugs, but two, you know, why can you give the same exact drug overseas cheaper? Answer, because those countries can negotiate the price, and, you know, we were not being allowed to by our own laws. So it's well overdue, in my opinion.
So in the mid-90s, I worked for Senator Kennedy as Director of Communications for the Labor and Human Resources Committee. And
Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts.
Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts. And that's when Clinton was president, and there was an intense focus for those years on health care reform. And this issue was top of mind at that time. So many, many hearings, many, many efforts to try to deal with this issue of how do you contain prescription drug costs, because in hearing after hearing after hearing, the key issues were the problem with not having access to health care because you have a pre-existing condition, and having access to health coverage in general, but how do you pay for prescription drugs? That people would have to choose between prescription drugs and food. Or they might have to, you know, maybe they'd get a prescription, but they wouldn't use all of it because they were trying to, you know, save money by not using all of it, which is very dangerous. This reaches into virtually every household, I think, across the country, and in one way or the other, either directly or indirectly. This is an incredible achievement by the Biden administration that's built on a foundation of years and years of primarily Democrats' efforts to get to this point where we are. It was in the Inflation Reduction Act, which, you know, was passed 2 years ago, I think signed into law yesterday, 2 years ago, maybe even today, but with no votes from Republicans. And on the Senate side, Vice President Harris, it was a tie vote, and she cast the deciding vote. And this is absolutely life-changing for people. And I know, in fact, I was speaking with somebody yesterday, a very dear friend of mine, who the insulin issue is a very, but a whole host of other medications, including some of these today. But the combination of solving the insulin issue, of reducing the cost of insulin, plus reducing these costs, is lifting a great weight off of her shoulders in terms of the financial strains that she's under. And I think, I would guess that same story is being told over and over. So if you talk about how to make a difference in people's lives and working people in particular, game-changing, totally game-changing. It will not only lower the cost of the drugs, but it also caps your yearly out-of-pocket drug costs, and so that it saves for older Americans, saves money that way as well. And I will note that authors of Project 2025, Heritage Foundation, others who are the so President Trump, he can't say, well, I disavowed Project 2025, because he repeatedly says we're going to cancel everything that was in the Inflation Reduction Act, right? That's what he says. We're going to cancel it. We're going to give the money back. And but Project 2025 calls for drug price negotiation programs to be repealed. And so here we are. Major, major, major victory by the Biden administration. And this shows, because with each person that you elect comes a team of people, right, at the different agencies. And this was long time, hard fought negotiations that got us to this point.
Yeah, I don't blame, and I certainly wouldn't try to demonize, big pharma CEOs who are trying to maximize shareholder value. This is one of their important jobs. The question is, should that consideration stand alone, independently of all of the other interests we have in this country, to include the ability of our citizens to have access to key pharmaceuticals without going broke? For years and years and years, private insurers have been negotiating with the pharmaceutical industry, to drive down prices as best they can for their for their own clients. Why not Medicare?
Right.
It just strikes me that anybody who purports to take an interest in the fiscal situation of the United States would want to try to reduce Medicare costs as much as possible. Given the fact that some discounts have already been achieved through private companies, the overall change here based on what I can see is about a 22% cost reduction. And barring a substantial political change that could happen in November, the next 10 pharmaceuticals to be negotiated will be announced on the 1st of February 2025. So this is an ongoing process. I suspect there is, notwithstanding past votes, there will be some tension within a Trump administration, if this is what happens, as to whether or not to continue this. I suspect the incoming vice president in a Trump administration may favor continued negotiations to drive down these costs. There's a tension. There are still the more traditional Republicans, many of whom are still inclined to rely on campaign contributions from Big Pharma. There are others who supposedly at least have made a sort of populist transition. And and maybe inclined to continue to work with this system. Too early to tell. But this seems overall to be a very good development.
The other thing that I think it's important to note is, and maybe you alluded to this, that these drugs often emerge out of research that is government funded. Not always, but often. Even if the final drug is not, some of the core research that gets you to there is government funded research. And so these guys didn't get there on their own. They might have done the last part themselves, but not the whole part. And so there's a lot of public money in their research. And the other thing is, if they want to contain their costs, they could constrain the amount of funding that they spend on advertising, because the drug company advertising budgets are enormous. And they also, you know, drive sales.
Yeah, all you got to do is watch the TV news.
Absolutely.
For 5 seconds.
For 5 seconds. And that has actually changed the patterns of drug use. And so if they want to look for some cost-cutting measures, why don't they look at their advertising budgets?
To that point, Deborah wrote in to panel at WAMC.org and says, the scandal is direct-to-consumer advertising, more spent here than on R&D. The public can't get the medication without a prescription, so why advertise to individuals? It's outrageous.
Well, because what happened? Well, first of all,
because they create demand with the
doctors. Well, there's two answers there, right? One is they do have direct to doctor. Okay, so somebody shows up at the doctor's office, says, "Here's what we're selling. Here's some free samples, etc." Okay, patient comes in, says, "I'd like to try X. I saw the TV commercial from it." You know, you get push from both sides. I would point out that the other reason a lot of people are concerned about this is, depending exactly what you call healthcare costs and things like that, but undeniably healthcare costs is becoming the highest percentage of our GDP, gross domestic product. It's now at approaching 20%, and then it's higher than that if you take out some of the, you know, there's these adjusted GDPs, of which about 3% comes from Medicare. So in other words, 3% of our gross domestic product, 3% of all the money spent in the U.S. is this Medicare spending. So, I mean, we're talking about a huge amount of money. It's about $1 trillion a year. And, you know, being able to cut that down
to contain
is just
as a ripple effect.
Stunning.
And we also need to think about, and I don't know if it's still the number one cause of bankruptcy, but I know when I was focused on healthcare more intensely, it was that medical bankruptcy was a leading cause of bankruptcy in this country. It might be housing now, I'm not sure, but medical bankruptcy is a crippling problem in this country, and it's because of medical costs. And if you can contain, you know, today, Vice President Harris is talking about her economic agenda, unveiling her economic agenda, and I know that Trump last night did his thing. I don't know. They called it a press conference, whatever it was. An hour of talking, five, and then I think he took 5 questions or something. But a lot of that, you know, prices are too high. Well, if you want to get at some core prices that are too high, it's the cost of health care. And interestingly enough, I was having an unplanned conversation with some young people last night because I had to seek out a coffee shop because I didn't have internet access. And so I did what I've started to do lately is ask these young people where they get information and what issues of concern to them. And the one thing that there was consensus on was the biggest issue for all of them was healthcare. Access to healthcare. Yeah. And that one, they didn't miss a beat on saying that. The other stuff, they were kind of foggy on what issues, who's running for what. But immediately, I said, what's the thing that you're most concerned about? How to pay for healthcare?
I have a child who's has serious health issues, adult child. And, you know, if we weren't able to bankroll even the cost of, they're in Massachusetts, which has some of the best health care coverage at the lowest prices in the country, they'd be out on the street. I mean, they're unemployed because of the medical situation. In the old days, they wouldn't even be able to get insurance because it's a pre-existing thing. So you know, Obamacare has essentially saved my family, and you know, we would be unquestionably upper middle class. So you know, these things really do affect people. And Teresa, I just checked, and it's still among the top three. They don't have an exact breakdown, but healthcare is still among the top three causes of personal bankruptcy.
Yeah. And I know it was a long time ago, but when we were doing hearings around the country and on the healthcare legislation, some of the most devastating stories were the people who lost everything trying to save their child, their spouse, whatever. Yeah. They lost their house. They lost everything trying to save them from a healthcare concern. It was tragic. I like I'm going to tear up now. I'm still thinking about it.
Yeah, no, we're in this country. We are still a long, long, long ways away from having a civilized healthcare system. As important as these negotiations over drug prices are, the success here is a Band-Aid. It's a Band-Aid on a gaping wound, and this is something we need to get serious about. And I have basic questions about how serious we can become on this systemically, given the way we fund our politics in this country.
Well, one of the things, many things that disturbs me about the Trump rallies, but the thing that I think bothers me most because of the work that I've been focused on for so long on healthcare is when he throws out the line that says, and I'm going to get rid of the, Obamacare, and then there's a loud cheer. And I think of how many children now have health care. Millions and millions of children now have health care. Young people have health care. People with pre-existing conditions have health care coverage because of that. And I've been interested to hear, as he answers reporters' questions, he then starts hedging. Well, maybe not until we have a replacement. Well, you were president for 4 years, Donald Trump, and you never had a replacement. And the Republicans have been saying for years and years that they're going to get rid of Obamacare and replace it with something better. But you don't even have internal within the Republicans this agreement. And when you do that, you are putting anybody who has a pre-existing condition, you are putting their life, their health care at risk, their personal and family economy at risk.
So does this give us cause for optimism that if there is a second Trump administration, Obamacare is going to survive?
No, I think that they're reckless. If you look at Project 2025, I think they're reckless. And even if it does survive in its current form, what you've seen that the Biden administration has done is continuously try to improve it at the edge. And I would beg to differ with you about these price changes on drugs. I think it's more. I get your broad point, but I do think this is a really significant change. This one is not an incremental change. This is to get control of drug prices.
If it continues.
But if Trump wins and big pharma money prevails, then you probably won't see that next list of 10 drugs, right? And they also, if they bring in the Trump people to lead the Health and Human Services. I mean, you saw what they did around the pandemic, right? You saw how they handled the pandemic. And if they gut these agencies and don't listen to the experts and don't spend their time, I mean, again, this is down in the weeds, but you're talking about Medicare spending. The Clinton administration came in and Bill Clinton brought in HHS a team of people to crack down on Medicare cheats, not people who were using the system, but the doctors and those others. And they saved millions of dollars. And then the Republican administration comes in, they disband that unit.
Teresa, when I describe this as a Band-Aid, I don't mean to minimize the importance.
I get
of
your
it.
Larger point, but on
the,
that
the larger point I think is that when these decreases go into effect in 2026, we may indeed see fewer people going broke over medical costs. The fact that in the United States of America, anybody should go broke over medical costs is something that should be absolutely unacceptable. Right. And that's why I call this a Band-Aid.
Yeah.
Charles writes in and says, I wouldn't crow about the drug price negotiations. They don't go into effect until 2026. Plenty of time for Trump, if he gets elected, to cancel it. My question is, why didn't the new prices go into effect at the end of this year? It seems like the government is giving pharma a pass. We also heard from John, who says, agreeing with a lot of what you've said, saving billions on drugs is another example of the need for government intervention that we would not see under a Trump administration. Cheryl writes in and says, so obvious that the country is in favor of big corporations versus individuals' health. If you need a drug, you should not go broke getting it, Medicare or not. Some people will look back and shame the society for how they handled healthcare in the U.S. We also heard from Mike, who says, there's a direct and relatively simple solution to our healthcare system: decommodify healthcare and implement a publicly funded universal system. The problem with this approach is that our politics have been so thoroughly captured by interests, e.g. insurance and pharmaceutical lobbies, that they will fight to the death against such a change.
Yeah, the insurance lobby is like the pharmaceutical lobby. Pharma is really powerful.
Jill writes in and says, it's good that these drugs may now cost Americans less, but it's only 10 drugs. This is a drop in the bucket. There are several thousand more medications that are seriously overpriced. All this celebrating this achievement is very overblown. I think the VA can negotiate its drug prices. Celebrate when all Americans can get lower cost medication.
Well, you know, I would say hear to that. But understand, this was a negotiation as part of the Inflation Reduction Act.
Right.
And the Republicans are the ones who forced the 2026 date. They also were the ones who held it to 10 per, and yet then every one of them voted against it.
Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Hard luck and trouble is my only friend. I've been on my own ever since. Welcome to the final segment of this week's roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue, in studio with Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Fred Hoff. Music by Melissa Etheridge, who is touring with the Indigo Girls and playing Bethel Woods next Wednesday. The playlist is posted online at WAMC.org. The Democratic National Convention will run from Monday, August 19th, that's this coming Monday, through Thursday, August 22nd. It'll be held at two venues in Chicago, Illinois, the United Center and McCormick Place. The United Center is an arena that will host most of the public events. McCormick Place is for more daytime events. Normally, the convention would include a roll call vote to formally select the nominees for president and vice president, but not this time. Ms. Harris and Mr. Walls were officially nominated through an early roll call vote held online. This means the main activity at this year's convention will be twofold: the speeches and confirming of the party platform. The number of protesters at the Republican convention in Milwaukee was smaller than many expected, but large crowds are expected to protest at the Democratic convention. The larger protests will most likely take place on the first and last days of the convention, and protesters have been fighting with Chicago officials over where they will be allowed to march. Teresa.
So excited.
You're so excited. It's your Super Bowl. It's four nights.
It's four nights. Monday is, they don't have the full schedule out yet, which is typical, but Monday night, President Biden gives us essentially the keynote from Monday night, but it reportedly Hillary Clinton will also be speaking that night, which is, I think, interesting framing. Tuesday night, President Barack Obama is essentially the keynote. And then Wednesday, it will be Vice President Tim Walz' night. The Wednesday night's the Vice President night, and reportedly Bill Clinton will be speaking that night. And then Thursday night is Vice President Harris, and I'm not sure who will introduce her. Some speculate it will be her husband, but not sure who. But that's the broad pattern. Now,
and we all agree it should be Taylor Swift or Beyonce, right?
No, I think they
should. I know that.
I think that, I hope at some point there is a Taylor Swift event, but we'll see whether that's got to be in the biggest arena possible, or maybe online. But you know, maybe Beyonce and Jay-Z show up in Chicago. You never know, right? I wouldn't be surprised if Beyonce shows up, not necessarily singing, but it is interesting to, just as a process matter, having I was a deputy director of the Democratic platform in 1988, which is ages ago, and then worked at the 92 convention. 88 was in Atlanta, 92 was in Clinton in New York. But the thought of having to reconfigure a convention at the last minute like they have is really kind of mind-boggling, because these take a long, long time to prepare. So this transition will be interesting. But again, I think that the Harris campaign is built on the foundation of the Biden-Harris record, so it's still highlighting the same things, but how they choose to do it. And also they're teasing that there will be some sort of, even though they don't have to do the roll call, because they had to do it in advance of Ohio deadline, so they did a virtual roll call. It sounds like they are going to do something. And in the pandemic last time, they ended up doing a very creative roll call where they did videos from each of the states, and some of them went viral, and that ended up to be a lot of fun. So watch for maybe something fun that's a roll call-like activity that engages all of the states. But I think the key is to, this is an opportunity to further introduce the vice president and the president, and then to get out the core messages. And presumably, if they stay on track, the overall message will be one of a joyful campaign that really matters in people's lives and invites and engages people. And I read some data last night that showed that there's been an enormous bump in the number of people registering to vote, and they're registering to vote as Democrats in many cases, particularly among young people. And one hopes in the next, over those Monday through Thursday, that there are watch parties and other outreach with all of these interest groups that have been forming, and that that translates into action, including getting people registered.
I was going to say, the other thing I found interesting is it's very clear they're paying attention to some of the down ticket
absolutely
issues. So, you know, Governor Huckel has announced she'll be one of the speakers. And, you know, again, which governors get asked and why has always been a mystery to me. But in this particular case, I suspect it's to bolster New York, bolster New York Democrats, and to
because
really
there are
try
five
to get
really
back
critical
the four
seats.
Or five seats that the Republicans took.
So I did read that there's going to be a panel of women governors, that it's going to be hosted by Julia Louise Dreyfus. I don't know on what night, but it's Governor Whitmer, from Michigan, Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs, Kansas Governor Laura Kelly, Maine Governor Janet Mills, Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey, New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, New York Governor Kathy Hochul, and Oregon Governor Tina Kotek. And that brings me such great joy, because I'm old enough to remember when, you know, there were women governors. And to be able to read those names of all women governors, I know it's hokey, but that's very moving to me.
Well, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, in addition to being one of the funniest performers in the world, is a very smart, passionate person who is always engaging to watch in whatever she takes on. So that is exciting, and it's happening on August 21st, according to CNN.
August 21st?
Yes.
And thank you for that. And Jason Carter, who's a grandson of Jimmy Carter, who will turn 100 in October, and his family says he's bound and determined that he's going to vote for the Vice President Harris to put the first woman in as the presidency. But he's going to be there on behalf of his grandfather. So that'll be fun, too. I don't know what his speaking spot is. And I also read that Yusuf Salam, who was New York City Council member and one of the exonerated five, or people know him as the Central Park Five, and remember that Donald Trump did the horrible thing of bringing an ad in the New York Times basically condemning the Central Park Five, and they eventually were exonerated, but he's now an elected official, and he will have some role. And I think you'll see that there are a lot of personal story people presumably will have speaking roles. But it'll be interesting to see how they use that platform to convey their core messages.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. And there are a couple of things that occur to me about this convention. You know, first of all, I suppose, and Teresa, I obviously defer to you on this, but the overall political objective here is to reintroduce Vice President Harris to the country, or perhaps expand the introduction to people who may not have been exposed to her yet. And to sustain the momentum of her candidacy. I read The Economist. It's my favorite publication, and it's interesting. The Economist now, in its examination of American polls, is saying that Harris actually has a 52% chance of winning this election. That's quite a turnaround from just a few weeks ago, when The Economist was saying that the odds on Mr. Trump over President Biden were 2-1. And clearly, the way I understand the convention is set up, normally I would think a sitting president would be speaking much deeper into the convention. And I would say the same thing for the party's candidate in 2016. Here, there appears to be an effort to put them up front, in a sense, get past them, and then build up steadily to the new candidate. I just find that interesting. The other thing we'll need to keep an eye on is the question of protests. We have just reached the 40,000 mark in terms of people killed in the Gaza Strip. There are high and strong feelings about this, and as was noted earlier, there are negotiations going on with the municipality of Chicago over where and when people can protest. One of the key messages of former President Trump and his campaign is that American cities are in a state of chaos and carnage under current management, and they will be hoping to have some measure of that somehow substantiated if these protests move in a certain direction. So these are things I'll be looking at.
Yeah, I certainly think how the media covers the protests versus what's inside is going to be a very big issue, and hopefully it'll stay peaceful. Hopefully, we won't see manipulation of the crowds and things like that, and hopefully you won't see the insane police response that we had in
think,
Chicago last night.
You know, there was sort of a conservative news drumbeat that was almost, pushing toward that, but I think that certainly I think that seems to have subsided, and hopefully there's not instigators in there who change it. But overall, I think, Fred, you're right, that this launch of the vice president has been, I dare say, almost flawless in terms of they have used every cycle, the initial launch for her, the launch for the vice president, and then, the lead up to the vice president's choice got them coverage all over. Now this weekend they're doing a, bus tour, I think, through Pennsylvania. Anyway, to leading up to this, she's announcing her economic agenda today, and this gives them 4 nights of if all goes well, just really strong coverage. And this introduces her, but it also helps inoculate against what will be hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising trying to redefine her. You're already seeing what they're doing with Waltz around Swift boating on his very stellar record of service, military service to our country, and they're trying to sully that up. And they're already trying to, you hear Trump denigrating her and saying he has a right to call her names. But I think that the more joyful and positive and information-filled her campaign is, the more petty and petulant and weak he has almost seemed to look, right? She has figured out a way to, I think, deflate him and certainly confuse him.
And, I must say, I think their campaign is brilliant in the sense of, so Walsh showed up at a event wearing a camo hat, camouflage hat, with Harris Waltz on it. And that created such a social media uproar among the MAGA crowd that they're now selling it on, you can buy them on their website.
And they're selling ads as fast as they can make them.
They're like,
But they have, the left is reclaiming
camouflage. You know how to poke.
Yeah. They have influencers. They've invited influencers into
the
White House. They've invited influencers. They had an event for creatives yesterday, the day before, at the White House. They have influencers who are coming, and they've encouraged them to come to the convention.
A bunch of comedians I follow have been bowling at the White House lately, and the context of this?
They understand how to reach people where they are, and particularly how to reach younger people. And they're not disparaging the fact that younger people aren't getting their news from newspapers. They're leaning into where they are getting their information, and they are feeding that beast.
We're just about out of time here. I wanted to mention briefly that for the first time in convention history, an ADA-compliant ramp has been built to provide direct access to the convention floor. This custom first-of-its-kind ramp at the United Center will ensure that delegates, media volunteers, and guests who require accommodations are able to access the convention floor, ensuring that everyone can experience this convention in full. Seems late, but at least it's happening. The panel this morning has been Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Fred Hoff. Thank you all. Hope you have a lovely weekend and a great DNC to you, Teresa.
Enjoy the convention all. Tune in whatever way you do.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.